Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. You know, next month, at the start of next month, Podbean, who are the podcast hosting host platform that I use for this podcast, have agreed to make A Year of War and Peace their podcast of the week for, I can't remember what week, but one of the weeks in July, and that's going to give us a bit of a boost in numbers. The reason I bring this up is because yesterday we had the biggest day so far. Typically we average about 150 downloads per day. On a big day that hits 200 or so. Yesterday we had 326. It was the first day to go above the 300 mark, so that's a bit of a milestone. 300 people listened to my stupid voice yesterday. I think that's kind of hard to believe. So, I want to thank the people who share the podcast, because that's playing a big part in the growth, and also the Patreon subscribers, because that helps as well. My big idea was to do a bit of a push when we are podcast of the week, and see if we can bump those numbers up, see if we can maybe hit our first 350 download day, or even 400 download day. And then I thought, you know what, why not do a push in the lead up to that. See if we can't hit some kind of critical mass. So this is me asking you, yet again, to please share the podcast with your friends. Alright, let's have a look at Book 9, Chapter 3. The Emperor of Russia had meanwhile been in Vilna for more than a month, reviewing troops and holding maneuvers. Nothing was ready for the war that everyone expected, and to prepare for which the Emperor had come from Petersburg. There was no general plan of action. The vacillation between the various plans that were proposed had ever increased after the Emperor had been at headquarters for a month. Each of the three armies had its own commander-in-chief, but there was no supreme commander of all the forces, and the Emperor did not assume that responsibility himself. The longer the Emperor remained in Vilna, the less did everybody, tired of waiting, prepare for war. All the efforts of those who surrounded the sovereign seemed directed merely to making him spend his time pleasantly and forget that war was impending. In June, after many balls and fetes given by the Polish magnates, by the courtiers, and by the Emperor himself, it occurred to one of the Polish aides-de-camp in attendance that a dinner and ball should be given for the Emperor by his aides-de-camp. This idea was eagerly received. The Emperor gave his consent. The aides-de-camp collected money by subscription. The lady, who was thought to be most pleasing to the Emperor, was invited to act as hostess. Count Bennigsen, being a landowner in the Vilna province, offered his country house for the fete, and the 13th of June was fixed for a ball, dinner, regatta, and fireworks at Zakrit, Count Bennigsen's country seat. The very day that Napoleon issued the order to cross the Niemen, and his vanguard, driving off the Cossacks, crossed the Russian frontier, Alexander spent the evening at the entertainment given by his aides-de-camp at Bennigsen's country house. It was a gay and brilliant fete. Connoisseurs of such matters declared that really, rarely had so many beautiful women been assembled in one place. Countess Bezukhova was present among the other Russian ladies who had followed the sovereign from Petersburg to Vilna, and eclipsed the refined Polish ladies by her massive, so-called Russian type of beauty. The Emperor noticed her and honored her with a dance. Boris Drubetskoy, having left his wife in Moscow and being for the present, in garçon, as he phrased it, was also there, and, though not an aide-de-camp, had subscribed a large sum towards the expenses. Boris was now a rich man, who had risen to high honours, and no longer sought patronage, but stood on an equal footing with the highest of those of his own age. He was meeting Helena in Vilna after not having seen her for a long time, but did not recall the past. But as Helena was enjoying the favours of a very important personage, and Boris had only recently married, they met as good friends of long standing. At midnight, dancing was still going on. Helena, not having a suitable partner, herself offered to dance the mazurka with Boris. They were the third couple. Boris, coolly looking at Helena's dazzling bare shoulders which emerged from a dark gold-embroidered gauze gown, talked to her of old acquaintances, and at the same time, unaware of it himself and unnoticed by others, never for an instant ceased to observe the Emperor, who was in the same room. The Emperor was not dancing. He stood in the doorway, stopping now one pair and now another with gracious words that he alone knew how to utter. As the mazurka began, Boris saw that Adjutant General Balashev, one of those in closest attendance on the Emperor, went up to him and, contrary to court etiquette, stood near him while he was talking to a Polish lady. Having finished speaking to her, the Emperor looked inquiringly at Balashev and, evidently understanding that he only acted thus because there were important reasons for doing so, nodded slightly to the lady and turned to him. Hardly had Balashev begun to speak before a look of amazement appeared on the Emperor's face. He took Balashev by the arm and crossed the room with him, unconsciously clearing a path 7 yards wide as the people on both sides made way for him. Boris noticed Arakcheev's excited face when the sovereign went out with Balashev. Arakcheev looked at the Emperor from under his brow and, sniffing with his red nose, stepped forward from the crowd as if expecting the Emperor to address him. Boris understood that Arakcheev envied Balashev and was displeased that evidently important news had reached the Emperor otherwise than through himself. But the Emperor and Balashev passed out into the illuminated garden without noticing Arakcheev, who, holding his sword and glancing wrathfully around, followed some 20 paces behind them. All the time Boris was going through the figures of the mazurka, he was worried by the question of what Balashev had brought, and how he could find it out before others. In the figure in which he had to choose two ladies, he whispered to Helena that he meant to choose Countess Potocka, who he had thought had gone out onto the veranda, and glided over to the parakeet, to the door opening into the garden, where, seeing Balashev and the Emperor returning to the veranda, he stood still. They were moving towards the door. Boris, fluttering as if he had not had time to withdraw, respectfully pressed close to the doorpost with bowed head. The Emperor, with the agitation of one who has been personally affronted, was finishing with these words. "To enter Russia without declaring war? I will not make peace as long as a single armed enemy remains in my country." It seemed to Boris that it gave the Emperor pleasure to utter these words. He was satisfied with the form in which he had expressed his thought, but displeased that Boris had overheard it. "Let no one know of it," the Emperor added with a frown. Boris understood that this was meant for him, and closing his eyes slightly bowed his head. The Emperor re-entered the ballroom and remained there about another half hour. Boris was thus the first to learn the news that the French army had crossed the Niemen, and thanks to this was able to show certain important personages that much that was concealed from others was usually known to him, and by this means he rose higher in their estimation. The unexpected news of the French having crossed the Niemen was particularly startling after a month of unfulfilled expectations and at a ball. On first receiving the news, under the influence of indignation and resentment, the Emperor had found a phrase that pleased him, fully expressed his feelings, and has since become famous. On returning home at 2 o'clock that night, he sent for his secretary, Shishkov, and told him to write an order to the troops and a rescript to Field Marshal Prince Saltykov, in which he insisted on the words being inserted that he would not make peace so long as a single armed Frenchman remained on Russian soil. Next day the following letter was sent to Napoleon. "Monsieur mon frère, yesterday I learnt that, despite the loyalty with which I have kept my engagement with your Majesty, your troops have crossed the Russian frontier and I have this moment received from Petersburg a note in which Count Lauriston informs me as a reason for his aggression that your majesty has considered yourself to be in a state of war with me from the time Prince Kurakin asked for his passports. The reasons on which the Duke di Bassano based his refusal to deliver them to him would never have led me to suppose that that incident could serve as a pretext for aggression. In fact, the ambassador, as he himself has declared, was never authorized to make that demand, and as soon as I was informed of it, I let him know how much I disapproved of it, and ordered him to remain at his post. If your majesty does not intend to shed the blood of our peoples for such a misunderstanding, and consents to withdraw your troops from Russian territory, I will regard what has passed as not having occurred, and an understanding between us will be possible. In the contrary case, your majesty, I shall see myself forced to repel an attack that nothing on my part has provoked. It still depends on your majesty to preserve humanity from the calamity of another war. I am, signed, Alexander. There's a strange bit of punctuation there. It says, I am, and, like an ampersand symbol, C dot comma. Ampersand C dot comma. I don't know if that's a typo. Looks like a typo. Anyway, there we go. Another chapter down. And I think Alexander's been pretty polite there, unless he's just being fearful, but that comes across as respectful and polite. Almost like, hey buddy, you seem to be doing a bit of war on us. I think there might be a misunderstanding. If you want to back out, we'll just pretend nothing happened. Otherwise, we're going to have to do war. The question is, was he being very respectful and honestly saying, I think you've been mistaken? Or was it sort of a last-ditched fear of trying to buddy up to your enemy? Turtle Vader said, the Russians are busy pretending there is no impending war and seem determined to distract Emperor Alexander with parties. Is this procrastination to be expected? Do you think there are any generals taking the threat seriously? Well, from what we've seen so far, it doesn't really seem like anyone's taking the threat seriously. It's sort of like a surprise threat. Royal Lenigan said, I looked on Google Maps and it looks like Vilno, or modern day Vilnius, where Alexander was partying until he heard of war, is only about 100 kilometers from where Napoleon was crossing the Niemen River at Kovno, or modern-day Kaunas. I wonder how much Alexander knew about the encroaching troops before he was told of their crossing. So they are pretty close. 100 kilometers is not that far in the grand scheme of things, in a place like Russia especially. That's a drop in the ocean. Well, actually I say that, but now thinking about the fact that it's in the 1800s and everything was on foot or on horseback, I suppose that's probably, what, a few days march? The question, is this procrastination to be expected, is a funny one, because it's not surprising, isn't it? Is it? After what we've seen of the Russian army, it's sort of like, it's a bit of a shambles, and they don't seem to take anything too seriously. The French are in the country, they've crossed the river, and, you know, Alexander is trying to make preparations for war, but no one's really taking responsibility for it. And no preparations have been undertaken, from what I can gather, or very little at least. It could be a case of Boris to the rescue, because he's overheard that the French are there, and he could blow the whole thing open, and maybe that's what needs to happen. Maybe someone needs to tattle and tell everyone, hey guys, the French are here, they've crossed the river. It was also cool to see that Boris has shot up through the ranks, which, you know, he kind of knew he was going to do, but now he's a rich man and he's very influential and he just seems to be in the right place at the right time always, doesn't he? Even with that little tidbit, he just seemed to be leaning on the right doorpost at just the right moment to overhear the emperor say that the French were in the country. And now he's, you know, one of the very first people, other than the messengers, I suppose, he was like the first person to know that that was the case, that the French had arrived. Partly you could say that's luck, but he does create the situation where that can happen. He's always trying to get to the right place at the right time around the right people. He's always got his ear to the ground. He plays the game well, that Boris. All right, that's going to do us for today's reading, today's episode. Thanks very much for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.